Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Peter in Washington. Today is May 28, 1979, and this is my audio letter number 46. In most all the black nations of Africa, criminals and internal enemies of the state do not last long. People disappear in the dead of night, never to be seen or heard from again. And when they disappear, their families know they are gone for good. They know anything about it. Taken to a secret place that is spoken of only in prison black Africa. A place is usually known as the pit. The victim is blindfolded and led through the nighttime darkness to the edge of the pit. There, kerosene is poured over him until he is thoroughly soaked. Then, as the victim screams in vain, the torchbearer approaches. Moments later, the scene around the pit is illuminated as the kerosene catches fire. Then the victim is pushed over the edge to fall alive, but aflame into the pit. In most all black Africa, that's how law and order is kept. But that is not the only place where people are rumored to disappear in silence. Lately, there have been reports of wholesale disappearances in Argentina. A few days ago, on May 22nd, the BBC put the number of disappearances at 4,000 since 1976. And a few days before that, on May 16th, the New York Times ran a story titled, Vanished in Argentina. The article referred to a major story in the Buenos Aires Herald, and also quoted from a related newspaper advertisement. Included were the words, quote, the most capable and most renowned people become used for keeping quiet, unquote. To most Americans, nighttime disappearances in Africa probably don't seem very relevant. We relax and say to ourselves, maybe that's Africa, but it's different here. This is America. Argentina may strike a little closer to home, since Argentina is a modern, advanced nation. Even so, most of us are likely to comfort ourselves that this is America, not Argentina. It's different here, we think. Well, my friends, it is different here. In Africa, the natives may talk only in whispers about disappearances and the pit. But whispers travel fast. Everyone knows about the pit. In Argentina, too, the people at least know disappearances are going on, because so far, the press has been left free to publish reports about them. But it is here in the United States that the most momentous disappearances are now taking place. It began 4 months ago with the murder of Nelson Rockefeller. Now, important and famous people are disappearing. Nelson Rockefeller's murder has been followed by convulsions in the rulership of America. And yet, there is no hint to the public about what is taking place. The Rockefeller murder in January signaled the beginning of an all-out Bolshevik coup d'etat here in America. A secret Bolshevik purge of Rockefellers was underway, bloody but hidden from public view. The last month, I revealed that a secret intelligence war between doubles had erupted for control of the United States government. When I recorded audio letter 45 last month, the situation was confusing and my information was still fragmentary. But I told you what I could, and now I can tell you more. The war of doubles involves not only the Bolsheviks, but the clandestine services of Russia, Great Britain, and Israel. But the basic battle lines are being drawn between Russia and the Bolsheviks. As of now, the Russians appear to be gradually gaining the upper hand, thanks to their use of an astonishing new intelligence weapon. There is irony in what the Russians are now doing in the War of Doubles. They're raising the ghost of none other than Nelson Rockefeller, and in a way that he would have appreciated. My three topics this month are, topic number one, Nelson Rockefeller's revenge from the grave. Topic number two, the Cosmosphere shuttles to prevent nuclear war. And topic number three, a modern rebirth of the Holy Alliance. Topic number one. In the summer of 1976, a missile crisis erupted between Russia and the United States, which to this day has never been made public officially. As all my older listeners know, I'm referring to the underwater nuclear crisis of 1976. The Russian Navy was planting small, short-range, underwater-launched nuclear missiles within the territorial waters of the United States. They were doing the same thing in selected other locations worldwide. They were preparing for a surprise nuclear first strike against the United States, involving not ICBM, but a naval strategy. By this means, they were hoping to bring America to her knees with one swift blow. But if that failed, they were prepared for all-out war. It was a desperate gamble by the Kremlin, far more dangerous than the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. In a military double-cross, the Kremlin was terminating unilaterally the secret Rockefeller-Soviet alliance of nearly six decades. But nuclear war did not erupt then, thanks primarily to the brave actions of just one man. That man was the late General George S. Brown, then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It was he who persuaded then-President Gerald Ford to give the order, overruling Henry Kissinger, to remove the Russian missile from American waters. On the 11th, 16th, that September, I revealed the loyal, brave actions of General Brown in preventing future war. Those actions include my own lengthy meeting with him at the Pentagon on September 16, 1976. For doing his duty, General Brown very soon encountered reprisals against him. It began in October 1976, soon after my meeting with him. The major media began cutting him down, and he was even forced to apologize on national television for some alleged remarks that were 6 months old. Up until then, General Brown had been famous for his outspoken, forthright behavior. But after that, he quickly faded into obscurity. He did not actively serve out his term as chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and reportedly died of cancer soon after retiring. In audio letters 17 and 23, I revealed how the fate of General Brown was tied directly to a drastic reversal in America's fortunes. But until now, I have never revealed what finally happened to General Brown. Now at last I can tell you. I'll return to the matter of General Brown after telling you some other things which you need to know first. The neutralization of General Brown was part of an effort by the late four Rockefeller brothers to reinstate their former secret alliance with the Soviet Union. The brothers simply could not believe at first that the alliance was gone for good. It was not until mid-1977 that they received evidence convincing them that their old allies in Russia, the atheistic Bolsheviks, were being overthrown. Up until then, the brothers were still trying to glue things back together. In this regard, a little-known practice of the late Nelson Rockefeller is now acquiring crucial importance. Of the four brothers, Nelson in particular always lived in fear of being assassinated. Like a moth drawn to a flame, he craved the limelight and yet feared it at the same time. Most of all, he was always worried that someone close to him, someone he himself had placed in power, could someday double-cross him. And as I reveal in IO letter 43, his fears were well-founded. For Nelson Rockefeller, the lust for power was rivaled by only one other emotion, revenge. He never forgot a grudge. For example, 3 decades ago, a young California congressman named Richard Nixon marked himself for Rockefeller's hatred. Nixon went after an intimate associate of Rockefeller named Alger Hiss, charging treasonous activity by Hiss. Finally, Hiss wound up behind bars, not for treason, but for perjury in connection with treason. Rockefeller was enraged and vowed to do in Nixon one day. Later, when Rockefeller created the 25th Amendment to the United States Constitution, he kept Nixon in mind. The 25th Amendment was the means by which Rockefeller intended to become president without being elected. The stage was set for a scandal called Watergate, and Nixon was maneuvered into the Oval Office so that it would be he who was ruined by Watergate. As planned, Nixon left the presidency in disgrace, and Hiss left prison as a sympathetic figure in the major media. In the same way, Nelson Rockefeller wanted to make sure that if he should ever be murdered, he would have his revenge, even from the grave. And so over the years, he made a habit of keeping a complete list of all the people placed in important positions by his brothers and himself. Periodically, he provided copies of the latest list to certain elements within Russia's intelligence community. His political testament contained instructions that were very simple. If anybody ever killed me, use the list. Find out who did it. I don't care if you have to get rid of everybody on the list. Just do it. In doing this, the one thing he never anticipated was that the Rockefeller-Soviet alliance itself would come apart. Even so, the Rockefeller hit lists are now coming into their own in a way that he could never have anticipated. because the Bolsheviks who carried out the coup d'etat against the Rockefellers are also the enemies of the new ruling faction in Russia. So Russia, for her own reasons, is now using Nelson Rockefeller's hit list and the secret intelligence war now going on. They know exactly whom to go after here in America and have known for years. And they have been preparing for years to be in a position to use the list if that turned out to be the best way to proceed. Here, my friends, is where the new Russian intelligence weapon enters the picture. What I am about to reveal, I am revealing primarily for history. I know, even before I reveal it, that some of my listeners will desert me after they hear it, saying, it just cannot be. But, my friends, I also know that the events of the days ahead will be impossible to understand without knowing this secret. So I do not ask that you believe it, simply because I say it. What I do ask, and I ask it for your own good, is that you keep an open mind. Listen and hear what I must now reveal. Then watch the events themselves. My friends, since World War II and before, scientists the world over have been probing for the basic secrets of life itself. And in this field, as in others, progress has been much faster than the public has been led to believe. Today, it's common knowledge that heredity is governed by something called genes. Yet barely a generation ago, this relationship was only beginning to be suspected. When it was suggested in 1944 by a theoretical physicist, Erwin Schrödinger, it was a novel idea. Beyond that, no one was too certain what genes were, aside from huge molecules or clusters of molecules. Some thought they were molecular chunks of protein. Some thought they were something else. When Schrödinger's ideas about genes were published, World War II was still raging, and basic scientific research was on the back burner. And yet, barely a half a dozen years later, researchers were zeroing in on a building block of life even more basic than genes. The solution was found in this revolutionary puzzle in April 1953 at Cambridge University in England. Scientists James Watson, Francis Crick, and Maurice Wilkins were later to share the Nobel Prize for solving the puzzle. They had discovered the molecular structure of DNA, the famous double helix. In 1968, Watson published a book titled The Double Helix, published by Athenian, New York, New York. To understand the overwhelming importance of the double helix discovery in 1953, one need go no further than these few words on the jacket of the book. Quote, DNA is a molecule of heredity, and to know its structure and method of reproduction enable science to know how genetic directions are written and transmitted, how the forms of life are ordered from one generation to the next, unquote. In other words, to understand DNA is to begin to understand life itself. It has now been over a quarter century since the crucial discovery of the DNA double helix, and since then, research in molecular biology has not been standing still, but speeding up. In some cases, research has gone in directions which are deliberately sheltered from publicity because of the fear of public reaction. Not so long ago, for example, universities doing research into artificial microbes found their neighbors in an ugly mood when they found out about it. Test tube babies are now a reality, and that began not long ago in England, where the mystery of DNA was first unraveled. Then, of course, there are clones. That is, creatures which are reproduced by artificial means and which are exact duplicates of an original. Clones of all kinds of animals have been produced successfully in the laboratory, but that is not what bothers people. In the recent past, it has been claimed that human clones are also possible and that some may already be in existence. These last claims about human clones have been ridiculed, denied, and suppressed by all kinds of officials. The reason is that the idea of duplicate human beings impinges upon a super-secret realm of intelligence activities by both Russia and the United States. True clones are not involved, but something that bears a superficial resemblance to cloning is going on. And the last thing the powers that be want is for you and the public that I have any hint about what is afoot. In Russia, as well as in the West, research has been underway for many years in biological synthesis. That is artificial life form. And according to high intelligence, a stunning breakthrough took place in Russia some years ago. The Russians refer to this breakthrough as a providential discovery, something they learned almost by accident. They discovered the key to creating what are known as organic robotoids. An organic robotoid is an artificial robot-like creature. It looks and acts exactly like a human being, and yet it is not human. A robotoid is alive in a biological sense, but it is an artificial life form. Robotoids respond to conventional routine medical tests in the same way as humans do. They eat, they drink, they breathe, they bleed, they cut, and they can be killed. Robotoids can also think, but they think only in the sense that a computer thinks. Like any other computer, the brain of a robotoid has to be programmed for each assignment it is given. But unlike many electronic computers, the biological computer brain of a robotoid possesses an enormous memory. As a result, robotoids can be programmed to communicate and think in such complex patterns that they act human. Organic robotoids are remarkable creatures, but they have many drawbacks. They don't grow or reproduce, but must be manufactured one by one in the desired form. They also have a very limited lifespan, measured in months or even weeks, depending upon how they are utilized. This is due to the fact that their metabolism, while it resembles that of humans, is very inefficient. A robotoid can be manufactured on very short notice, a matter of hours. But after a few weeks or months, it suddenly begins to degenerate physically and mentally. When that takes place, the robotoid has to be removed from service and disposed of. To extend its useful life as much as possible, a robotoid is customarily cooled down to slow its metabolism between assignments. Organic robotoids are extremely expensive, troublesome creatures to produce and utilize. And robotoid capabilities do not exceed those of human beings. All they can really do is simulate human beings. But my friend, for intelligence purposes, that's all they have to do. To produce an organic robotoid, it is necessary to have a pattern to go by. The pattern required is that of genetic coding, taken from a few cells in the body of a human being. In this respect, the Russian technique sounds like cloning. But the technique itself is totally unrelated to genuine cloning. A robotoid is produced within a matter of hours and assimilates a human donor at his current age. Like any man-made copy of anything, a robotoid is never a perfect copy of the human that is to be simulated. There's always small discrepancies in appearance and behavior, but these are seldom great enough to arouse any suspicion. An initial Russian breakthrough in robotoids took place years ago. The Rockefeller-Soviet alliance was still functioning. The Christian group who now rule Russia were already secretly more powerful than the Bolsheviks, but the final overthrow had not yet taken place. When the robotoid breakthrough took place, they moved quickly to minimize the amount of information obtained about it while those Bolsheviks still retained positions of power. They also tried to prevent information about it from leaking through intelligence channels to the CIA. Nevertheless, partial information did reach the CIA and the late four Rockefeller brothers. By early 1975, the Russians were known to have successfully created at least one organic robotoid in the laboratory. Meanwhile, the CIA was coordinating a feverish research effort aimed at accomplishing the same feat. Up to now, robotoid technology in the United States is far behind that of Russia. The American capability in robotoids is not even close to being operational, whereas the Russians are deploying them right now. But there has been at least one attempt to create an organic robotoid for public use in the United States. And I'm referring to the final fate of the late General George S. Brown. In April 1977, I revealed how much General Brown had sacrificed by that time as a price of doing his duty for America. But not long after that, General Brown paid the supreme price for his actions. It is only now that I am free at last to reveal it. On July 10, 1977, General Brown was taken to CIA headquarters near Washington, D.C. in Virginia. There he was taken to one of the many secret rooms designed into the CIA building by Nelson Rockefeller. The room was a laboratory. An attempt was made to create a robotoid replacement for General Brown. The techniques employed were far more crude than those used in the Russian process, since the CIA process required General Brown to be on the scene. The attempt ended in complete failure. A crude facsimile of General Brown was generated, but it refused to come to life. Even so, General Brown could not be allowed to live, because now he knew too much. And so, on the evening of July 10, 1977, General George S. Brown, the last great patriot in the United States government, was murdered. A normal human double was found for General Brown, since the robotoid attempt had failed. This was the man who testified in the role of General Brown at the congressional hearings on the Panama Canal Treaty, September 27, 1977. At his side throughout, briefing and prompting him, was the Secretary of Defense, Harold Brown. Occasionally, the double would be flustered by a question and look down at the table in front of him until the defense secretary whispered something in his ear. Then he would look up again, say what he had been told, and so on. Once the Panama Canal hearings were out of the way, the double for the late General Brown was seen as little as possible in public. Soon there were stories that he had contracted cancer. Then the Air Force Chief of Staff, General David Jones, began acting as chairman of the Joint Chiefs, months before the end of General Brown's tour of duty. In June 1978, we were told that General Brown was retiring, and last December the 5th, 1978, we were told he had died of cancer. At that point, the General Brown double collected his pay and headed for Frankfurt, West Germany, where he landed on December 11, 1978 at 3:30 a.m. local time. It is a standing rule that doubles for important people never live long. And so, at about 7:30 that evening, General Brown's double was shot to death in the back of the neck. Last month, I revealed that an intelligence war of doubles had erupted in the United States. President Carter, Vice President Mondale, and their wives had fallen victim to this war of doubles as their Easter breaks away from Washington were ending. Now I'm sorry to report that Amy Carter, Billy Carter, Lillian Carter, and Hugh Carter all died soon after Jimmy and Rosalind did. All of them, including Amy, have been replaced by doubles. But instead of the Bolshevik doubles, who had been waiting in the wings, those we are seeing are Russian organic robotoids. The voice of the Jimmy Carter double, which was reproduced last month in audio letter 45, is the voice of a robotoid. That robotoid was the one who was dazzling everyone with his vigorous new image. Only a few months ago, Carter had been limping around with what we were told were severe hemorrhoids. But now, out of the blue, here was a Carter who was a powerhouse, hiking, fishing, and jogging 10 miles a day. He also looked and sounded younger than before. That was the first robotoid double for Carter, which I referred to last month as Carter number 2. By the time I recorded audio letter 45, there was also another Carter robotoid making the rounds. This one, Jimmy Carter number 3, was the one that attended the Holocaust observances in the Capitol building here in Washington. By contrast with Carter number 2, number 3 looks noticeably older and more haggard. As I mentioned earlier, robotoids are very good copies, but they are not perfect. No two look exactly alike. Last month, I mentioned that the doubles for Jimmy and Rosalind Carter were spending a great deal of time at the Russian embassy here in Washington instead of at the White House. Now I can tell you why. Robotoids are programmed at the embassy for each assignment. Between assignments, they simply rest there in a state of reduced metabolism. When the Bolshevik coup d'etat against the Rockefellers began 4 months ago, the Kremlin rulership already knew that Bolshevik doubles would soon be on the scene. And they knew that if the Bolsheviks were allowed to complete their takeover of the United States, Russia would soon suffer. The Bolshevik plans for nuclear war against Russia are a blueprint for suicide for America, but they have not been abandoned. Up until now, the Russians had been keeping the robotoid capability under wraps, and there was a real question whether they would ever be used. But the Bolshevik coup d'etat convinced them the time had come to deploy the robotoid. Now, they are using Nelson Rockefeller's hit list. By using their Robotoid, the Russians have already altered the course of world events in dramatic ways.
This is the end of Side 1.